angrily when Jink got into his master's backpack.
"You're taking the new marten with you, and the old one must be put on the chain?"
asked Roxanne when she came back to them with the root for nettle.
"Yes, because someone said he'd bring me bad luck." "Since when have you believed in that kind of thing?"
"Indeed, since when? Since I met an old man who claims to have made you up, and me," thought Dustfinger. Gwyn was still hissing. He had seldom seen the marten so angry. Without a word, he took the chain off Gwyn's collar again, and ignored Farid's look of alarm. All the way to Ombra, Gwyn sat on Farid's shoulders, as if to show Dustfinger that he hadn't forgiven him yet. And the moment Jink put his nose out of the backpack, Gwyn bared his teeth and snarled so menacingly that Farid had to hold his muzzle shut a couple of times. The gallows outside the city gates were empty. Only a few ravens were perched on the wooden beams. Even though Cosimo was back, her ugliness was still administering justice in Ombra, just as she had done in his father's lifetime, and she did not think well of hangings. Perhaps because, as a child, she had seen too many men dangling from a rope with their tongues blue and their faces bloated.
"Listen," Dustfinger said to Farid as they stopped beneath the gallows. "Well, I take Nettle the Root and ask Cloudancer for a message I'm told he has for me. You go and find Maggie. I must talk to her."
Farid went red, but he nodded. Dustfinger looked at his face with amusement. "What's all this? Does something besides Cosmo's return from the dead happen on the evening when you went to see her?"
"None of your business,"
muttered Farid, blushing more deeply than ever. A farmer, swearing profusely, was driving a cart laden with barrels toward the city gates. The oxen blocked the gateway, and the guards impatiently grabbed the reins. Dustfinger took this chance to get himself and Farid past them.
"Bring Maggie here all the same,"
he said as they parted on the other side of the gates.
"And don't get so lovesick that you lose your way."
He watched the boy until he had disappeared among the houses. No wonder Roxanne thought Farid was his son. Sometimes, he suspected his own heart of thinking the same. Chapter 34 Cloud Dancer's Message. There could hardly be a worse smell in the world than the odor rising from the dyer's vats. The acrid stench rose to Dustfinger's nostrils even as he was making his way along the alley where the smiths plied their trade. Tinkers mending pots and pans, blacksmiths shoeing horses, and on the other side of the road, the armorers, who were considered superior to the other smiths, and were arrogant as befitted their status. The sound of all the hammers beating on red-hot iron was almost as bad as the smell in the alley. The dyers had their hovels in the most remote part of Ombra. Their stinking vats were never tolerated in the better parts of any town. But just as Dustfinger was approaching the gate separating their quarter from the rest of Ombra, a man coming out of an armorer's workshop collided with him. The Piper. He was easily recognizable by his silver nose, although Dustfinger could remember the days when he had a nose of flesh and blood.
"Just your luck again, Dustfinger,"
he told himself, turning his head aside and trying to slip past Capricorn's minstrel quickly.
"Of all the men in the world, that bloodhound has to cross your path."
He was beginning to hope that the Piper hadn't noticed who he had bumped into, but just as he thought he was safely past him, the silver-nosed man seized his arm and swung him around.
"Dustfinger!"
he said in the strained voice that once sounded so different. It had always reminded Dustfinger of oversweet cakes. Capricorn had loved to listen to it more than any other voice, and the same was true of the songs it sang. The Piper wrote wonderful songs about fire-raising and murder, so wonderful that they almost made you believe there was no nobler occupation than cutting throats. Did he sing the same songs for the Adderhead, or were they too coarse-grained for the silver halls of the Castle of Night?
"Well, fancy that. I'm inclined to think just about everyone's coming back from the dead these days,"
said the Piper, while the two men-at-arms with him looked covetously at the weapons displayed outside the armorer's workshops.
"I really thought Basta had sliced you up and then buried you years ago. Did you know he's back, too? He and the old woman, Mortola. I'm sure you remember her." The Adderhead was delighted to welcome her to his castle. You know how highly he always thought of her deadly concoctions.
Dustfinger hid the fear pervading his heart behind a smile.
"Well, if it isn't the Piper," he said. "Your new nose suits you much better than the old one. Tells everyone who your new master is, and shows that it belongs to a minstrel who can be bought for silver."
The Piper's eyes had not changed. They were pale gray like the sky on a rainy day, and they stared at him with as fixed a gaze as the eyes of a bird. Dustfinger knew from Roxanne how he had lost his nose. Cut off by a man whose daughter he had seduced with his dark songs.
"You always did have a dangerously sharp tongue, Dustfinger," he said. "It's about time someone finally cut it out. Indeed, wasn't that tried once and you got away only because the Black Prince and his bear protected you? Are they still looking after you? I don't see them anywhere."
He looked around, his eyes searching the scene. Dustfinger cast a quick glance at the two men-at-arms. They were both at least a head taller than him. What would Farid say if he could see me now, he wondered, that I ought to have had him with me so that he could keep his vow? The Piper had a sword, of course, and his hand was already on the hilt. He obviously thought as little as the Black Prince did of the law forbidding strolling players to carry weapons. A good thing the smiths are hammering so loudly, thought Dustfinger, for no doubt everyone would hear my heart beating with fear. "I must be on my way," he said as casually as possible. "Give Bastard my regards when you see him, and as for burying me, he hasn't done it yet." He turned. It was worth a try. But the Piper held his arm tightly.
"Of course, and you're Martin, too," he hissed.
Dustfinger felt Jink's damp muzzle against his ear. "That's the wrong Martin," he thought, trying to calm his racing heart. "The wrong Martin." But had Finolio ever mentioned Gwyn's name when he staged Dustfinger's death? With the best will in the world, he couldn't remember.
"I have to ask Bastard to give me the book back so that I can look it up," he thought bitterly.
He signaled to Jink to get into the backpack. "Better not think about that." The Piper was still holding his arm. He wore pale leather gloves, finely stitched, like a lady's.
"The Adderhead will soon be here," he told Dustfinger in an undertone. He didn't care at all for the news of his son-in-law's strange return to life. He thinks the whole business is a wicked masquerade designed to cheat his defenseless grandson of the throne.
Four guards came down the street wearing the Laughing Prince's colors. Cosimo's colors now. Dustfinger had never in his life been so glad to see armed men. The Piper let go of his arm.
"We'll meet again soon," he hissed in his noseless voice.
"I dare say," was all that Dustfinger replied. Then he quickly pushed between a couple of ragged boys standing there and staring wide-eyed at a sword, made his way past a woman showing her battered cooking pot to one of the smiths, and disappeared through the dyer's gate. No one followed him. No one seized him and hauled him back. "You have too many enemies, Dustfinger," he thought. He didn't slow down until he came to the tubs from which the vapors of the liquid muck used by the dyers rose. The same miasma hung over the stream that carried the stinking brew under the city wall and down to the river. No wonder the water nymphs were found only above the place where it flowed into the main waterway. In the second house Dustfinger tried, they told him where to find Nettle. The woman he had been sent to had eyes red with weeping and was carrying a baby. Without a word, she beckoned him into her house, if a house it could be called. Nettle was bending over a little girl with red cheeks and glazed eyes. At the sight of Dustfinger, she straightened up, looking grumpy.
"Roxanne asked me to bring you this."
She glanced briefly at the root, compressed her narrow lips, and nodded.
"What's wrong with the girl?" he asked.
The child's mother had sat down by the bed again. Nettle shrugged. She seemed to be wearing the same moss-green garment as she had 10 years ago, and obviously, she still liked him as little as ever.
"A high fever, but she'll survive," she replied. "It's not half as bad as the one that killed your daughter, while her father was off jaunting around the world."
She looked him in the face as she said that, as if to make sure that her words went home.
But Dustfinger knew how to hide pain. He was almost as good at hiding pain as he was at playing with fire. "The route is dangerous," he said.
"Do you think you have to tell me that?"
The old woman looked at him as if he had insulted her.
"The wound it's to heal is dangerous, too. He's a strong man, or he'd be dead by now."
"Do I know him?"
"You know his wife."
What was the old woman talking about? Dustfinger glanced at the sick child. Her small face was flushed with fever.
"I heard that Roxanne let you back into her bed again," said Nettle. "You can tell her she's more of a fool than I thought. And now go around behind the house. Cloud Dancer's there. He can tell you more about the other woman. She gave him a message for you."
Cloud Dancer was standing beside a stunted oleander bush that grew near the Dyer's huts.
"That poor child. Did you see her?" he asked as Dustfinger came over to him. "I can't bear to see them so sick. And the mothers, you think they weep their eyes away. I remember how Roxanne—"
But here he broke off abruptly. "Sorry," he murmured, putting his hand into the breast of his dirty tunic.
I was forgetting she was your child, too. Here, this is for you."
He brought out a note on fine, pure white paper such as Dustfinger had never seen in this world before.
"A woman gave me this for you. Nettle found her and her husband in the forest in Capricorn's old fortress, and she took him to the secret camp. The man's wounded. Quite badly."
Hesitantly, Dustfinger unfolded the paper. He recognized the writing at once.
"She says she knows you. I told her you can't read, but—"
"I can read now," Dustfinger interrupted him. "She taught me."
"How did she come to be here?"
That was all he could think of as Reese's words danced before his eyes. The paper was so crumpled that it was difficult to decipher them, not that reading had ever come easily to him.
"Yes, she said so, too.
I told him, she told me."
Cloud Dancer looked at him curiously.
"Where did you get to know the woman?"
"It's a long story." He put the note in his backpack. "I must be off," he said.
"We're going back this evening, Nettle and I,"
Cloud Dancer called after him.
"Shall I tell the woman anything?" "Yes. Tell her I'll bring her daughter to her."
Cosimo's soldiers were still standing in the smith's alley, assessing the merits of a sword, something an ordinary man-at-arms could never afford. There was no sign of the piper. Brightly colored strips of fabric hung from the windows. Ombra was celebrating the return of its dead prince, but Dustfinger was in no mood to celebrate. The words in his backpack weighed heavily on him, even if he had to admit that it gave him bitter satisfaction to see that Silvertongue obviously had even less luck in this world than he, Dustfinger, had known in Silvertongue's. Did he know what it felt like to be in the wrong story now? Or hadn't he had time to feel anything before Mortola shot him? People were thronging the street leading up to the castle as if it were market day. Dustfinger looked up at the towers, from which the black banner still flew. What did his daughter think of the return of her mistress's husband?
"Even if you were to ask Brianna, she wouldn't tell you," he thought, turning back to the gate.
It was time to get out of here before he encountered the piper again, or even his master. Maggie was already waiting with Farid under the empty gallows. The boy whispered something to her, and she laughed.
"By fire and ashes," thought Dustfinger. "See how happy those two look, and you have to be the bearer of bad news yet again. Why is it always you?"
"Simple," he answered himself.
"Bad news suits your face better than good news."
Chapter 35 Ink Medicine. Maggie stopped laughing as soon as she saw Dustfinger approaching her. Why was his face so grave? Farid had said he was happy. Was it the sight of her that made him look so grim? Was he angry with her because she had followed him into his story, and her face reminded him of years that he surely wanted to forget?
"What does he want to talk to me about?" she asked Farid.
"Probably familial," Farid had said. "And probably Cosimo, too. He wants to know what the old man is planning." as if she could have told Dustfinger that. When he stopped in front of her, there was not a sign on his face of the smile that she had always found so hard to interpret. "Hello, Maggie," he said. A marten blinked sleepily out of his backpack, but it wasn't Gwyn. Gwyn was sitting on Farid's shoulders and hissed as the other marten's nose showed above Dustfinger's shoulder. "Hello," she said awkwardly. "How are you?" It was strange to see him again. She felt both pleased and distrustful. Behind them, people were flowing ceaselessly toward the city gate. Peasants, tradesmen, entertainers, beggars, everyone who had heard of Cosimo's return. Although there were no telephones or newspapers in this world, and only the rich wrote letters, news traveled fast here.
"Fine. Yes, I'm really fine."
Now he was smiling after all and not in his usual enigmatic way. Farid had told the truth. Dustfinger was happy. It almost seemed to embarrass him. His face looked so much younger, in spite of the scars. But suddenly it turned grave again. The other marten jumped down on the ground when his master took the backpack off his shoulders and brought out a piece of paper.
"I meant to talk to you about Cosimo, a prince who has so surprisingly come back from the dead," he said, unfolding the crumpled piece of paper. "But I think I'd better show you this first."
Baffled, Maggie took the note. When she saw the handwriting, she looked at Dustfinger with incredulity. How had he come by a letter from her mother, here in this world? But all he said was, "Read it." And Maggie read it. The words were like a noose going around her neck, drawing tighter with every word, until she could scarcely breathe.
"What is it?" asked Farid uneasily. "What does it say?"
He looked at Dustfinger, but Dustfinger did not answer. As for Maggie, she was staring at Reese's words.
"Mortola! Mortola shot Mo!"
Behind them, people were pushing forward to see Cosimo, the brand new Cosimo. But why should she be interested? Nothing else mattered to her now. There was just one thing she wanted to know. "How?" she said, and looked at Dustfinger in desperation. "How come they're here? And how is Mo? It's not too bad, is it?" Dustfinger avoided her eyes.
"All I know is what it says there," he said. "Mortola shot your father. Reese is with him in the secret camp, and she asked me to look for you. A friend brought me her note. He's going back to the camp soon with Nettle. She..."
"Nettle? Reese told me about her," Maggie interrupted him. "She's a healer, a very good one. She'll make Mo better, won't she?"
"Of course," said Dustfinger, but he still didn't look at her.
Farid's gaze moved from him to Maggie in confusion.
"Mortola shot Silverton?" he stammered. "Then the route's for him. But you said it was dangerous."
Dustfinger cast him a warning glance, and Farid fell silent.
"Dangerous?" whispered Maggie. "What's dangerous?"
"Nothing. Nothing at all. I'll take you to them right away."
Dustfinger slung the backpack over his shoulder. "Go to Finolio and tell him you'll be away for a few days. Tell him Farid and I will be with you. I don't suppose the news will relieve his mind too much, but that's too bad. Don't say where we're going, and don't say why. News travels fast in these hills, and it would be better," he added, lowering his voice, "if Mortola doesn't find out that your father's still alive. The camp where he is now is known only to the strolling players, and they've all had to swear an oath never to let anyone who isn't one of us know about the place. But all the same..."
"Oaths are made to be broken,"
Maggie finished his sentence. "You said it." Dustfinger looked at the city gate. "Now go. It won't be easy to get through that crowd, but hurry all the same. Tell the old man there's a minstrel woman who lives on the hill.
He knows who Roxanne is," Maggie interrupted.
"Of course." This time Dustfinger's smile was bitter. "I keep forgetting he knows all about me. Right. Tell him to let Roxanne know I must be away for a few days, and ask him to keep an eye on my daughter. I suppose he knows who she is, too." Maggie just nodded. "Good," Dustfinger went on. "Then tell the old man something else. If a single one of his accursed words harms Brianna, he'll rue the day he ever thought up a man who can summon fire."
"I'll tell him,"
Maggie whispered. Then she ran off, pushing and shoving her way through the crowds of people trying to get into the city.
"Mo," she thought. "Mortola shot Mo."
and her dream came back to her. Her red, red dream.
Fenoglio was standing at the window when Maggie stumbled into his room.
Good heavens! What do you think you look like?
He exclaimed.
Didn't I tell you not to go out while all these people are thronging the streets? But that boy only has to whistle and you go running to him like a well-trained puppy.
Stop that!
Snapped Maggie so abruptly that Fenoglio actually did fall silent. You have to write something for me, and fast! She hauled him over to his desk where Rosenquartz was quietly snoring away.
Write what?
Confused, Fenoglio dropped into his chair.
It's my father,
faltered Maggie, taking one of the freshly sharpened quill pens out of the jug with shaking fingers.
He's here, but Mortola has shot him. He's very sick. Dustfinger didn't want to say so, but I can tell from the way he looked. So please write something, anything that will make him well again. He's in the forest in the Strolling Player's secret camp. Please, hurry.
Fenoglio looked at her in bewilderment.
Shot your father, and he's here? But why? I don't understand.
You don't have to understand, cried Maggie desperately. You just have to help him. Dustfinger's going to take me to him, and I'll read him better, understand? I mean, he's in your story now. You can even bring back the dead, so why can't you heal a wound, too? Please!
She dipped the pen into the inkwell and put it into his hand.
Heavens, Maggie, murmured Fenoglio, this is bad, but with the best will in the world, I don't know what to write. I don't even know where he is. If at least I knew what the place looks like.
Maggie stared at him. Suddenly the tears she had been holding back all this time were flowing.
Please, she whispered. Just try. Dustfinger's waiting outside by the gate.
Fenoglio looked at her and gently took the pen from her hand.
I'll try then, he said hoarsely. You're right. This is my story. I couldn't have helped him in the other world, but perhaps I can here. Go to the window,
he told her when she had brought him two sheets of parchment.
And look out of it. But look at the people on the streets or the birds in the sky. Occupy your mind somehow. Just don't look at me or I won't be able to write.
Maggie obeyed. She saw Minerva and her children down in the crowd, and the woman who lived opposite. She watched pigs grunting as they pushed past the people, soldiers with the Laughing Prince's emblem on their chests. Yet she wasn't really seeing any of it. She just heard Fenoglio dip his pen in the inkwell, heard it scratching over the parchment, pausing, and writing on again.
Please, she thought, please let him find the right words, please.
The pen fell silent for a painfully long time, while down in the street a beggar pushed a child aside with his crutch. Time passed slowly, like a shadow spreading. People thronged the streets, one dog barked at another, trumpets sounded from the castle, ringing out above the rooftops. Maggie couldn't have said how much time had passed when, with a sigh, Fenoglio put down his pen. Rosenquartz was still snoring, stretched out straight as a ruler behind the sandbox. Fenoglio reached into the box and sprinkled sand over the wet ink.
Did you think of something? Maggie hesitantly asked.
Yes.
Yeah.
But don't ask me if I got it right.
He handed her the parchment, and her eyes skimmed the words. There weren't many of them, but if they were indeed the right words, they would be enough.
I didn't make him up, Maggie, said Fenoglio in a soft voice. Your father isn't one of my characters like Cosimo and Dustfinger and Capricorn. He doesn't belong here, so don't hope for too much, will you?
Maggie nodded as she rolled up the parchment.
Dustfinger wants you to keep an eye on his daughter while he's gone.
His daughter? Dustfinger has a daughter? Did I write that? Oh, yes.
Indeed, weren't the two of them?
You know one of them anyway. She's Brianna. Her ugliness is made.
Brianna?
Fenoglio looked at her in astonishment.
Yes.
Maggie picked up the leather bag that she had brought with her from the other world and went to the door.
Look after her. I'm to say that if you don't, you'll rue the day you ever thought up someone who can call on fire.
He said that?
Fenoglio pushed back his chair and laughed.
You know something? I like him better and better. I believe I'll write another story about him. A story where he's the hero and he doesn't die?
Maggie opened the door.
I'll tell him, but I think he's had more than enough of being in one of your stories.
But he is in one. He came back into my story of his own free will,
Fenoglio called after her as she hurried down the steps.
We're all in it, Maggie, up to our necks in it. When are you coming back? I want you to meet Cosimo.
Maggie did not reply. How was she to know when she'd be coming back?
You called that hurrying? Asked Dustfinger when she was standing before him again, out of breath and putting Fenelio's parchment in her bag.
What's the parchment for? Did the old man give you one of his songs for nourishment along the way?
Something like that, replied Maggie.
Just so long as my name's not in it, said Dustfinger, turning toward the road.
Is it far?
Called Maggie as she hurried after him and Farid.
We'll be there by evening, said Dustfinger over his shoulder.
Chapter 36 Screams. The white women were still there. Risa didn't seem to see them anymore, but Mo felt their presence like shadows in sunlight. He didn't tell her about them. She looked so tired. The one thing that still kept her going was her hope that Dustfinger would soon arrive, with Maggie.
You wait and see. He'll find her, Risa kept whispering to him when he shook with fever.
How could she be so sure? As if Dustfinger had never let them down, never stolen the book, never betrayed them. Maggie. The need to see her once again was even stronger than the enticing whispers of the white women, stronger than the pain in his breast. And who could say? Perhaps this accursed story might yet take a turn for the better. Although Mo remembered Fenelio's preference for unhappy endings only too well.
Tell me where... It looks like outside,
he sometimes whispered to Risa.
It's ridiculous to be in a whole different world. I see nothing of it but a cave.
And Risa described what he couldn't see. The trees so much taller and older than any trees he had ever set eyes on. The fairies like swarms of gnats among the branches. The glass men in the tall bracken. And the nameless terrors of the night. Once she caught a fairy. Dustfinger had told her how to do it, and she took it to him. She held a little creature in the hollow of her hands and put it close to his ear so that he could hear the fairy's chirping, indignant voice. It all seemed so real, however often he told himself it was made of nothing but paper and ink. The hard ground where he lay, the leaves that rustled when he tossed and turned in his fever, the bear's hot breath, and the black prince whom he had last seen in the pages of a book. Now the man himself sometimes sat beside him, cooling his brow and talking quietly to Risa. Or was it all just a fevered dream? Death felt real in this ink world, too. Very real. It was strange to encounter death here in a world out of a book. But even if the dying was made only of words... Even if, perhaps, it was nothing but a game played by the letters on the page, his body thought it was real. His heart felt fear. His flesh felt pain. And the white women had not gone away, even if Risa couldn't see them. Mo felt them near him every minute, every hour, every day, and every night. Fenelio's angels of death. Did they make dying easier than it was in the world he came from? No. Nothing could make it easier. You lost what you loved. That was death. Here, as well as there. It was light outside when Mo heard the first scream. At first he thought the fever was taking hold of him again, but then he saw from Reese's face that she could hear it too. The clash of weapons and screaming, cries of fear, death cries. Mo tried to sit up, but the pain pounced on him like an animal digging its teeth into his chest. He saw the Black Prince standing outside the cave, his sword drawn. He saw Risa jump up. Fever made her face blur before his eyes. But then Mo suddenly saw another picture. He saw Maggie sitting in Fenelio's kitchen staring at the old man in horror, full of pride, as he told her of the fine death scene he had written for Dustfinger. Oh, yes. Fenelio liked sad stories, and perhaps he had just written another.
Risa,
Mo cursed the way his tongue felt, heavy with fever.
Risa, go and hide. Hide somewhere in the forest.
But she stayed with him as she always had, except for that one day, the day when his own voice had banished her.
Chapter 37 Bloodstained Straw
Maggie had often felt frightened in the wayless wood of the Farid,
But it was different with Dustfinger. The trees seemed to rustle more loudly when he passed them. The bushes seemed to reach their branches out to him. Fairy settled on his backpack like butterflies on a flower, pulling his hair until he brushed them away, talking to them. Other creatures, too, appeared and disappeared, beings whose names Maggie didn't know either from Reese's stories or from any other source. Some of them no more than a pair of eyes among the trees. Dustfinger led them as purposefully as if he could see their road laid out like a red guideline before him. He never even stopped to rest, but took them on and on, uphill and downhill, going deeper into the forest every hour, away from human beings. When at last he stopped, Maggie's legs were shaking with exhaustion. It must be late in the afternoon. Dustfinger passed his hand over the snapped twigs of a bush, bent down, examined the damp ground, and picked up a handful of berries that had been trodden underfoot. "What's the matter?" asked Farid anxiously.
"Too many feet. Above all, too many boots."
Dustfinger swore quietly and began to go faster. Too many boots. Maggie realized what he meant when the camp appeared among the trees. She saw tents that had been torn down. A trampled campfire.
"You two stay here," Dustfinger ordered, and this time they obeyed.
They watched anxiously as he stepped out of the shelter of the trees, looked around, raised the tent panels, reached his hand into cold ashes, and turned over two bodies lying motionless near the fireplace. Maggie was going to follow him when she saw the corpses, but Farid held her back. When Dustfinger disappeared into a cave and came out again pale-faced, Maggie tore herself away and ran to him.
"Where are my parents? Are they in there?"
She recoiled as her foot struck another dead body.
"No, there's no one left in there. But I found this."
Dustfinger held out a strip of fabric. Risa had a dress with that pattern. The fabric was bloodstained.
"Do you know it?"
Maggie nodded.
"Then your parents really were here.
The blood is probably your father's."
Dustfinger passed a hand over his face.
"Perhaps someone got away. Someone who can tell us what happened here.
I'll take a look around. Farid!"
Farid hurried to his side. Maggie was going to thrust her way past the two of them, but Dustfinger held her back. "Listen, Maggie," he said, putting his hands on her shoulders. "The fact that your parents aren't here is a good sign. It probably means they're still alive. There's a bed in the cave. I expect your mother was nursing your father there. And I found a bear's paw print, which means the Black Prince was here. Perhaps all this was a plan to capture him, although I don't know why they would have taken the others."
"No, that I don't understand."
Before setting off with Farid in search of survivors, Dustfinger told Maggie to wait in the cave. The entrance was tall and broad enough for a man to stand in it upright. The cave beyond it led deep into the mountain. The ground was strewn with leaves. The blankets and beds of straw were arranged side by side there. Some of them, just the right size, for a child. It was not difficult to see where Mo had been lying. The straw in that place was bloodstained, like the blanket lying beside it. A bowl of water, an overturned wooden mug, a bunch of dried flowers. Maggie picked them up and ran her fingers over the petals. She kneeled down and stared at the blood-stained straw. Finolio's parchment was close to her breast, but Mo was gone. How could Finolio's words help him now?
"Try," something inside her whispered. "You can't tell how powerful his words are in this world. It's made of them after all."
She heard footsteps behind her. Farid and Dustfinger were back, and Dustfinger was holding a child in his arms, a little girl. She stared at Maggie wide-eyed, as if she were in a bad dream, couldn't wake up. "She wouldn't talk to me, but luckily Farid inspires rather more confidence," said Dustfinger, carefully putting the child down on her feet. "She says her name is Liana, and she's 5 years old, and there were a lot of men, silver men with swords, and snakes on their breasts. Not so very surprising, if you ask me. They obviously killed the guards and some of those who defended themselves, and then took the rest away, even the women and children. As for the wounded," he glanced briefly at Maggie, "they were clearly loaded onto some kind of cart. The men had no horses with them. The girl is here only because her mother told her to hide among the trees." Gwyn scurried into the cave, followed by Jink. The little girl jumped when the martens leaped up at Dustfinger. Then she watched, fascinated, as Farid took Gwyn off Dustfinger's shoulder and put him on his own lap.
"Ask her if there were other children here," said Dustfinger softly.
Farid held up 5 fingers and showed them to the girl.
"How many children, Liana?" The child looked at him and tapped first Farid's forefinger, then his second and third fingers.
Mara, Fabio, Tinka,
she whispered. Three, said Dustfinger, probably no older than she is. Timidly, Liana put out her hand to stroke Gwyn's bushy tail, but Dustfinger held her fingers in a firm grip.
Better not, he said gently. He bites. Try the other one.
Meggie, Farid came over to her, but Meggie did not answer him. She wound her arms tightly around her knees and buried her face in her skirt. She didn't want to see the cave anymore. She didn't want to see any of Finolio's world anymore, not even Farid or Dustfinger or the girl who didn't know where her own parents were either. She wanted to be in Eleanor's library, sitting in the big armchair where Eleanor liked to read, and she wanted to see Mo put his head around the door and ask what the book on her lap was. But Mo wasn't here. Perhaps he was gone forever. And Finolio's story held her fast in its black, inky arms, whispering terrible things to her about armed men who dragged away children, old people, the sick, mothers and fathers.
Nettle will soon be here with Cloud Dancer, she heard Dustfinger say. She'll look after the child.
What about us? Asked Farid.
I'll follow them, said Dustfinger, to find out how many are still alive and where they're being taken. Although I think I know.
Meggie raised her head. To the Castle of Night. Good guess. The girl put her hand out to Jink. She was still small enough to find comfort for her grief in stroking an animal's fur. Meggie envied her.
What do you mean, you'll follow them? Farid chewed Gwyn off his lap and stood up.
Exactly what I said. Dustfinger's face was as uncommunicative as a closed door.
I will follow them while you two wait here for Cloud Dancer and Nettle.
Tell them I'm trying to follow the trail and Cloud Dancer is to take you back to Umbra. He's not fast enough to follow me with his stiff leg. Then tell Roxanne what's happened so that she doesn't think I've vanished again. And Meggie will stay with Finolio. His face was as well controlled as ever when he looked at her. But in his eyes, Meggie saw all that she herself was feeling. Fear, anxiety, anger. Helpless anger.
But we have to help them! Farid's voice shook. How? The Black Prince might have been able to save them, but they've obviously caught him, and I don't know anyone else who's ready to risk his life for a few strolling players.
What about that robber everyone's talking about, the Blue Jay?
There's no such person. Meggie's voice was little more than a whisper. Finolio made him up.
Really?
Dustfinger looked at her thoughtfully.
I've heard otherwise. But still... Well, as soon as you're in Umbra, get Cloud Dancer to go to the strolling players and tell them what's happened. I know the prince has men at his command, men who are devoted to him and are probably well-armed as well, but I've no idea where they are. Perhaps one of the strolling players may know, or Cloud Dancer himself. I must try to get word to them somehow. There's a mill in Argenta called the Spelt Mill. It's always been one of the few places south of the forest where people can meet or exchange news without the risk that it will come to the Adderhead's ears at once. The miller is so rich, he doesn't even have to fear the men-at-arms. So, if anyone wants to see me, or has any idea of how we can help the prisoners, let him send news there. I'll drop in now and then to ask if any messages have come. Understand? Meggie nodded. The Spelt Mill, she repeated quietly, unable to look anywhere but at the blood-stained straw.
Right, Meggie can do all that, but I'm going with you.
Farid's voice sounded so defiant that the little girl, still kneeling silently beside Meggie, was upset and reached for her hand.
I'm warning you, don't start on about looking after me again.
Dustfinger's voice was so sharp that Farid lowered his eyes.
I'm going alone and that's that. You take care of Meggie and the child until Nettle comes, and then get Cloud Dancer to take you to Umbra.
No!
Meggie saw the tears in Farid's eyes, but Dustfinger just walked toward the cave entrance without another word. Gwyn scuttled in front of him.
If it gets dark before they arrive, he added, looking over his shoulder at Farid, they light a fire. Not because of the soldiers. They have what they've came for, but wolves and nightmares are always hungry. The wolves for your flesh, the nightmares for your fear.
Then he was gone, and Farid stood there, his eyes blurred with tears.
That bloody bastard, he whispered. That thrice accursed son of a bitch! But he'll soon see. I'm going to follow him. I will look after him. I swore I would.
Abruptly, he kneeled in front of Meggie and took her hand.
You will go to Umbra, won't you? Please, I have to go after him. I know you understand.
Maggie said nothing. What was there to say? That she wasn't going back any more than he was? He'd only have tried to persuade her not to go on.
Jink rubbed against Farid's legs and then scurried outside. The little girl ran after the marten but stopped at the entrance to the cave, a small, forlorn figure, all alone.
Like me, thought Maggie.
Without looking at Farid, she took Finolio's parchment out of her belt. The letters could scarcely be made out in the twilight that filled the cave.
What's that? Farid straightened up. Words. Only words. But better than nothing. Wait, I'll give you a light.
Farid rubbed his fingertips together and whispered. A tiny flame appeared on his thumbnail. He blew gently on the little flame until it grew like a flame of a candle, and then held his thumb above the parchment. The flickering light made the letters shine as if rose and quartz had retraced them with fresh ink.
Useless, something whispered in Maggie. The words will be useless. Mo isn't here. He's far away. He may not even be alive anymore. Shut up, she snapped at this internal voice. I'm not listening. This is all I can do. There's nothing else, nothing at all.
She picked up the blood-stained blanket, placed the parchment on it, and ran her fingers over her lips. The little girl was still standing outside the cave, waiting for her mother to come back.
Read it, Maggie. Farid nodded at her encouragingly.
She read it, her fingers clutching the blanket stained with Mo's dried blood.
Mortimer felt the pain. She thought she felt it herself, in the sound of every letter on her tongue, in every word that passed her lips. The wound was burning. It burned like the hatred in Mortola's eyes when she had shot him. Perhaps it was her hatred that was sucking the life out of him, making him weaker and weaker. He felt his own blood wet and warm on his skin. He felt death reaching out to him. But all of a sudden, there was something else, too. Words. Words that relieved the pain, cooled his brow, and spoke of love. Nothing but love. They made his breathing easier again, and healed the place where death had been flowing in. He felt the sound of them on his skin and deep in his heart. They echoed ever louder, ever more clearly through the darkness that threatened to swallow him up, and suddenly he knew the voice speaking the words. It was his daughter's voice, and the white women withdrew their pale hands as if they had burned themselves on her love. Maggie buried her face in her hands. The parchment rolled up on her lap of its own accord, as if it had served its purpose. Straw pricked through her dress as it had in the shed where Capricorn had once imprisoned her and Mo. She felt someone stroking her hair, and for a moment, a crazy moment, she thought Finolio's words had brought Mo back, back to the cave safe and sound, and everything was all right again. But when she raised her head, it was only Farid standing beside her.
That was beautiful, he said. I'm sure it helped. You wait and see.
But Maggie shook her head.
No, she whispered. No. Those were only beautiful words. But my father isn't made of Finolio's words. He's made of flesh and blood. He's made of flesh and blood. So what difference does that make?
Farid removed her hands from her tear-stained face.
Perhaps everything's just made of words. Look at me, for instance. Pinch me. Am I made of paper?
No, he wasn't. And Maggie had to smile when he kissed her, although she was still shedding tears. Dustfinger had not been gone long when they heard footsteps among the trees. Farid had taken Dustfinger's advice and made a fire, and Maggie was sitting close to him with the little girl's head on her lap. Nettle said not a word as she emerged from the darkness and saw the wrecked camp. Silently, she went from one dead body to another, looking for life where none was left, while Cloud Dancer, his face unmoving, listened to the message Dustfinger had left for him. It was only when Maggie asked Cloud Dancer to take a message, not just to Roxanne and the strolling players, but to Finolio too, that Farid fully realized she didn't intend to go back to Umbra any more than he did. His expressionless face didn't show whether he was angry or glad.
I've written my message for Finolio.
With a heavy heart, Maggie had torn a page for it out of the notebook that Mo had given her. On the other hand, what better use could she put it to than saving him, if it was still possible to save him? You'll find Finolio in Minerva's house in Cobbler's Alley, and it's very important that no one else reads the message.
I know the ink weaver,
Cloud Dancer watched Nettle draw a ragged cloak over the face of another dead man. Then he frowned at the sheet of paper with Maggie's writing on it.
There've been messengers who are aiming for words they carried. Hope these aren't that kind. No, don't tell me, he said defensively as Maggie was about to answer. Usually I ask the sender to tell me the words of any message I carry, but with this one I have a feeling I'd better not know.
What do you suppose she's written? Asked Nettle bitterly. No doubt she was thanking the old man for writing the songs that will bring her father to the gallows. Or is he to write a dirge for him, the Blue Jay's last song? I scented misfortune the moment I saw that scar on his arm. I always thought the Blue Jay was just a legend, like all the noble princes and princesses in other songs. Well, you were wrong there, Nettle, I said to myself, and you're certainly not the first to notice the scar. So the Inkweaver had to go and describe it in detail. Curse the old fool and his silly songs. Men have been hanged before because they were taken for the Blue Jay, but now it seems the Adderhead is the right man in his hands, and the game of playing heroes is over, protecting the weak, robbing the strong. Yes, it all sounds very fine, but heroes aren't immortal except in songs, and your father will find only too soon that a mask doesn't protect you from death.
Maggie just sat there and stared at the old woman. What was she talking about?
Why are you looking at me like that, so surprised? Asked Nettle. Do you think the Adderhead sent his men here for a few old strolling players and pregnant women or for the Black Prince? Nonsense. The Black Prince never hid from the Adderhead. No. Someone slipped off to the Castle of Night and whispered in the Adderhead's ear that the Blue Jay was lying wounded in the strolling player's secret camp and could easily be picked up, along with the poor players who were hiding him. It will have been someone who knows the camp and has surely been paid good silver for his treachery. The Adderhead will make a great spectacle of the execution. The Inkweaver will write a touching song about it, and perhaps someone else will soon wear the feathered mask, for they'll go on singing those songs long after your father's dead and buried behind the Castle of Night.
Maggie heard her own blood surging through her veins.
What scar are you talking about? Her voice was little more than a whisper.
Why, the scar on his left arm. Surely you must know about it. The songs say that the Adderhead's hounds bit the Blue Jay there when he was hunting their master's white stags.
Finolio, what had he done?
Maggie covered her mouth with her hand. She heard again Finolio's voice on the spiral staircase as they were going down from Bobulus's workshop.
I like to base my characters on real people. Not every writer does that, but in my experience it makes them more lifelike. Facial expressions, gestures, the way someone walks, a voice, perhaps a birthmark or a scar. I steal something here, something there, and then they begin to breathe, until anyone hearing or reading about them thinks they can touch them. I didn't have a wide choice for the Blue Jay.
Mo, Finolio had taken her father as his model.
Maggie stared at the sleeping child. She, too, had often slept like that, with her head in Mo's lap.
Maggie's father is the Blue Jay?
Farid beside her uttered an incredulous laugh.
What nonsense! Silver Tongue can't even bring himself to kill a rabbit. You mark my words, Maggie. The other head will soon realize that, and he'll let him go. Come on!
He rose to his feet and offered her his hand.
We must start out, or we'll never catch up with Dustfinger.
You're going after him now.
Nettle shook her head at such folly, while Maggie laid the little girl's head down on the grass.
Keep going south if you miss his trail in the dark, said Cloud Dancer. Due south, and then you'll reach the road sometime, but beware of wolves. There are many wolves in these parts.
Farid just nodded. I have fire with me, he said, making a spark dance in the palm of his hand. Cloud Dancer grinned.
Well done. Perhaps you really are Dustfinger's son, Roxanne suspects.
Who knows,
was all Farid would reply, and he led Maggie away with him. She followed him into the dark trees, feeling numb.
A robber. She could think of nothing else. He had made Mo into a robber, a part of his story. At that moment, she hated Finolio just as much as Dustfinger did.
Chapter 38. An Audience for Finolio. Finolio was pacing up and down his room. Seven steps to the window, seven back to the door. Maggie had gone, and there was no one who could tell him if she'd found her father still alive. What an appalling muddle. Whenever he began to hope he was getting things under control again, something happened that did not remotely suit his plans. Perhaps another man really did exist somewhere, a diabolical storyteller who was continuing his tale, giving it new twists and turns, unpredictable and unpleasant developments, moving his characters as if they were chessmen, or simply placing new ones who had nothing to do with his own story on the chessboard. And still, Cosimo had sent no messenger.
"Well, I must exercise a little more patience," Finoglio told himself. "He's only just ascended his throne. I'm sure he has a great deal to do. All his subjects wanting to see him, petitioners, widows, orphans, administrators, gamekeepers, his son, his wife. Oh, nonsense! I'm the one he should have sent for first of all!"
Finoglio uttered the words so angrily that he was startled by the sound of his own voice.
"I, the man who brought him back to life, who made him in the first place!"
He went to the window and looked up at the castle. The Adderhead's banner flew from the left-hand tower. Yes, the Adderhead was in Umbra and must have ridden like the devil to see in person his son-in-law newly back from the dead. He hadn't brought Firefox with him this time. No doubt the man was busy looting or murdering elsewhere on his master's behalf, but the Piper was still abroad in the streets of Umbra, always with a few men-at-arms in his wake. What did they want here? Did the Adderhead still seriously hope to place his grandson on the throne? No, Cosimo would never allow it. For a moment, Finoglio forgot his dark mood, and a smile stole over his face. If only he could have told the Adderhead who had wrecked his fine plans, a writer. Oh, how that would have angered him. They have given him an unpleasant surprise. He with his words, Maggie with her voice. Poor Maggie. Poor Mortimer. How pleadingly she had looked at him, and what a farcical performance he had put on for her. Yet how could the poor thing have thought for a moment that he could help her father, when he himself hadn't even brought Mortimer here, quite apart from the fact that Mortimer wasn't one of his creations in the first place? But that look of hers, he simply had not the heart to let her leave without any hope at all. Rosenquartz was sitting on the desk with his transparent legs crossed, throwing breadcrumbs at the fairies.
"Won't you stop that?" Finoglio snapped. "Do you want them to grab you by the legs and try throwing you out the window again? I won't save you this time, believe you me. I won't even sweep you up when you're a little pile of broken glass down there in a pig's muck. Garbage collector can shove you into his barrow instead. That's why take your bad temper out on me. Go ahead, easy, little man, glass man."
The glass man turned his back on Finoglio.
"You won't make Cosimo summon you any sooner, though."
Here, unfortunately, he was right. Finoglio went to the window. In the streets below, the excitement over Cosimo's return had died down, and perhaps the Adderhead's presence had cast a damper on it, too. People were going about their business again. Pigs were rooting about among the trash, children were chasing one another around the close-packed houses, and now and then an armed soldier made his way through the crowd. There were clearly more soldiers around than usual in Umbra now. Cosimo was obviously having them patrol the city, perhaps to prevent the men-at-arms from riding his subjects down again just because they were in the way.
"Yes, Cosimo will see to everything," thought Finoglio. "He'll be a good prince, insofar as any princes are good. Who knows, maybe he'll even allow the strolling players back into Umbra on ordinary market days soon." "That's it. That'll be my first piece of advice, to let the players back again," murmured Finoglio. "And if he doesn't send for me this evening, I'll go to him unasked. What's the ungrateful fella thinking of? Does he suppose men get brought back from the dead every day?"
"I thought he'd never been dead at all."
Rosenquartz clambered up to his nest. He was out of reach there, as he very well knew.
"What about Mickey's father, then, huh? Do you think he's still alive?" "How should I know?"
replied Finoglio irritably. He didn't want to be reminded of Mortimer.
"Well, at least no one can blame me for that," Massey growled. "I can't help it if they're all knocking my story around like a tree that just has to be thoroughly pruned to make it bear fruit."
"Pruned?
Huh,"
Rosenquartz piped up.
"No, they're adding things. Your story is growing, growing like a weed, and not a particularly pretty one either, if you ask me."
Finoglio was just wondering whether to throw the inkwell when Minerva put her head around the door.
"A messenger, Finoglio." Her face was flushed, as if she had run too fast. "A messenger from the castle. He wants to see you. Cosimo wants to see you." Finolio hurried to the door, smoothing down the tunic that Minerva had made him. He had been wearing it for days. It was badly crumpled, but there was no helping that now. When he had tried to pay Minerva for it, she had just shaken her head, saying he'd paid already. With all the stories he told her children, day after day, evening after evening, it was a fine tunic, though, even if the fairy tales for children had paid for it. The messenger was waiting down in the street outside the house, looking important and frowning impatiently. He wore the black mourning cloak, as if the Prince of Sighs were still on the throne.
"Oh, well, it will all be different now," thought Finolio. "It will most definitely be different. From now on, I, and not my characters, will be telling this story again."
His guide didn't even look around him as he hurried along the streets after the man.
"Surly oaf," Finolio thought.
But this character probably really was a product of his, Finolio's pen, one of the many anonymous people with whom he had populated this world so that his main characters wouldn't be rattling around on it on their own. A number of men-at-arms were loafing around outside the stables in the outer courtyard of the castle. Finolio wondered with annoyance what they were doing there. Cosimo's men were pacing back and forth up on the battlements, like hounds set to keep watch on a pack of wolves. The men-at-arms stared up at them with hostility.
"Yes, you look at that," thought Finolio. "There'll be no leading part in my story for your dark lord, only a death fit for a thorough-going villain."
Perhaps he'd invent another one sometime, for stories soon get boring without a proper villain, but it was unlikely that Meggie would lend him her voice to call such a character to life. The guards at the inner gate raised their spears.
"What's all this?"
Finolio heard the Adderhead's voice the moment he set foot in the inner courtyard.
"Are you telling me he's still keeping me waiting, you lousy fur-faced creature?"
A softer voice answered, apprehensive and scared. Finolio saw the laughing prince's dwarfish servant Tullio facing the Adderhead. He only came up to the prince's silver-studded belt. Two of the laughing prince's guards stood behind him, but the Adderhead was at the head of at least 20 heavily armed men, an intimidating sight, even if Firefox wasn't with them, nor was there any sign of the piper.
"Your daughter will receive you, sir."
Tullio's voice shook like a leaf in the wind.
"My daughter? If I want Violante's company, I'll summon her to my own castle. No, I want to see this dead man who's come to life. So you will now take me to Cosimo at once, you stinking brownie bastard."
The unfortunate Tullio began trembling.
"The Prince of Umbra," he began again in a thread of a voice, "will not receive you."
These words made Finolio stumble back as if he had been struck in the chest, right into the nearest rosebush where the thorns caught in his new tunic. What was going on? Cosimo wouldn't receive the Adderhead? Was that part of his own plan? The Adderhead thrust out his lips as if he had a bad taste in his mouth. The veins at his temples stood out, dark on his blotched and ruddy skin. His lizard-like eyes stared down at Tullio. Then he took the crossbow from the nearest soldier's hand, and as Tullio ducked like a frightened rabbit, aimed at one of the birds in the sky above. It was a good shot. The bird fell right at the Adderhead's feet, its yellow feathers red with blood. A goldmacher. Finolio had invented them especially for the castle of the Prince of Sighs. The Adderhead bent and pulled the arrow out of its tiny breast.
"Here, take that," he said, pressing the dead bird into Tullio's hand. "And tell your master that he has obviously left his common sense behind in the realm of the dead. I'll allow that to be some excuse this once, but should he send you to me with such an outrageous message when I next visit him, he'll get not a bird back, but you with an arrow in your breast. Will you tell him that?"
Tullio stared at the blood-stained bird he was holding and nodded. As for the Adderhead, he turned on his heel and waved to his men to follow him. Finolio's guide bent his head timorously as they marched past.
"Looking straight in the eye,"
Finolio told himself, as the Adderhead passed so close to him that he thought he could smell his sweat.
"You invented him."
But instead, he hunched his head between his shoulders, like a tortoise sensing danger, and did not move until the inner gate had closed behind the last of the men-at-arms. Tullio was still standing at the door that had shut behind the Adderhead, staring at the dead bird in his hand.
"Should I show it to Cosimo?"
he asked, looking distressed as they came up to him.
Oh, have it roasted in the kitchen and eat it if you like, Finolio's guide snarled at him. But get out of my way!
The throne room hadn't changed since Finolio's last visit.